This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 192. Today we speak with Sandy Finlayson about the founders of the Free Church of Scotland. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 192, and my name is Camden Busey. I'm here in the Craig Center in the library at the Westminster Theological Seminary, getting ready to begin a wonderful episode on a new book, a fairly recent book on the founders of the Free Church of Scotland. But let me introduce to you today our panel. We have Dr. Carl R. Truman, who is Professor of Historical Theology and Church History at Westminster Theological Seminary. Thanks so much for joining us again, Dr. Truman.
Great to be here, Camden.
And we're really excited to welcome to the program today Sandy Finlayson, who's Professor of Theological Bibliography and Director of Library Services here at the seminary. Thanks so much for joining us, Sandy. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Camden. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, it's been a long time coming, and I've had my eye on this book, and I'm so thankful to finally have it here in front of me. And having read it and having scheduled, we're going to be speaking about a portion of church history, Presbyterian history, that hasn't received much attention, at least in our resources and our website. So I'm very pleased and excited to fill that gap today, and we have somebody here who's more than capable of doing it. Before we get started, I do want to mention, of course, that Christ the Center and everything we do here at Reform Forum is listener-supported. If you are able to help, please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate and help us to continue to produce and distribute all these programs free of charge. We are in need, especially as this fall season is coming up and as we are going to be attempting to cover several conferences in the area. So we need your help and support so that we can do that work and that we can continue to bring you decent Reformed resources each and every week. So thank you so much of everything that you do to help. Please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. Well, gentlemen, it's this is the first time doing a recording here in the Craig Center, so it's nice. We have a lot of classes in here, so it's actually nice to be in here and not feel like I'm going to be examined on this material later, but maybe I will. Who knows? Dr. Truman, I'm beyond your grasp now. You have no church history licensure exam authority over me any longer.
The law of the OPC has a long arm, though, brother.
But if by God's grace I ever come up for ordination in our presbytery, at least you could still vote no against me for some unknown reason.
I can also ask difficult questions. You can also, I believe, as well.
You can also do that. Yes, yes. Well, the book here today we're speaking about is Unity and Diversity: The Founders of the Free Church of Scotland by Sandy Finlayson. It's by Christian Focus Publications. It's a wonderful book. Not only is it put together well, and it's a pleasure to read, but it also has many wonderful illustrations and pictures of the founders of the Free Church. It's a wonderful history and just a delight to read. And it's a compilation of 10 short biographies of some of these key figures. We're going to march through many of them today. Dr. Truman, maybe I'll let you open things up. As we set the scene, what were some of the cultural context and some of the ecclesiastical context surrounding the whole events of the beginnings of the Free Church of Scotland?
Well, Sandy will be able to put far more flesh on the bones than I can, but essentially the Church of Scotland divided in 1843 on the issue of patronage, who had the right to call a minister. The Act of Union between England and Scotland in 1707 had made it clear that the Scottish Presbyterian system, whereby patronage, the Anglican way of calling a pastor, would not be allowed in Scotland. This was overruled by the Patronage Act of 1712, which then set up nearly 150 or 130 years, really, of long legal discussion about the status of the rights of the congregation as opposed to landowners to call ministers to congregations. And in the 1830s, this issue came to a head, and a group led by Thomas Chalmers fought for the rights of congregations within the church. And then in 1843, when all legal avenues had finally been closed down, led what's called the disruption, effectively a separation from the established Church of Scotland to form the Free Church of Scotland. Culturally, it is, I'll just throw this out as an observation, it's interesting to note that many mainline Protestant denominations in Europe split in the 1830s and 1840s, so there are clear cultural and social tensions as well as theological tensions driving this. Mm-hmm. One thinks of the Oxford movement in the Anglican Church, the Afscheiding in the Dutch Reformed Church, and also the Swiss Reveil in Switzerland.
It's interesting to put these two together. I of course don't have a whole lot of experience with the history of the Free Church, but to see what's going on in the United States at the same time is a very formative time in the U.S. leading up to the Civil War. You have the old school and new school debates, and it's just interesting to see all the things going on the other side of the ocean. Very significant factors and a significant portion of Presbyterian history over there in Scotland. Sandy, can you help our listeners to understand a little bit about the establishment principle, what that is, and maybe what its significance is for understanding our understanding of ecclesiology?
The establishment principle is essentially the belief that there is a direct link between the church and the state. And what it involves is making legal provision for the support of religious ministries by the state. Now, lest we think that this is a totally bizarre idea, we need to remember that this was formulated in the Westminster Confession of Faith. In the original formation of the Westminster Confession, yeah. Chapter 23, Section 3, there is an explicit statement that says that it is the duty of the civil magistrate to support the church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so virtually everyone in Scotland accepted this principle, that there should be a link between the church and the state, and that it was the duty of the state to provide for the needs of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the American context, the American church revised the Westminster Confession in 1788 to remove the establishment principle. But at the time that we're talking about here, there was this direct link, and I think it is good for Presbyterians to remember that it does come directly from the Westminster Confession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not something totally out of the blue. We tend to think of things anachronistically and maybe read back current trends, or at least some Presbyterianism of the 1970s back into what was going on at the future, but that's not the case.
Yeah.
And still, this principle is still in effect, and there are many people in Presbyterian circles that are still very sympathetic to this. Mm-hmm. So it's not unusual.
Yeah, that's certainly the case.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no longer the establishment of religion in the same way that there was in the 19th century, but many people believe in the principle. That it is a sound biblical principle.
Mm-hmm.
Do you not think that historically it's proved itself to be a powerful agent of the secularization of the church, though?
Why do you say that?
Because it has. That is my observation of it. Church of Scotland today, profoundly secularized. Anglican Church, profoundly secularized. It seems to me that it's only in the sectarian manifestations of religion in a place like Britain, for example, that one finds orthodoxy in the Free Church of Scotland sense, has been preserved, even though the Free Church is itself hypothetically committed to the establishment principle.
Yeah.
And you knew I was going to ask it to wind you up as well. That's the other reason.
Yes, I did know you were going to ask this question. I'm not sure that you can make that direct link between secularization and the establishment principle. I think the principle rightly understood that says that Christ is both King of the nations and King of the church is defensible from the scripture, fits into the Reformed tradition. I would concede that it hasn't always worked itself out well, which I think is what Carla's referring to here. but that doesn't deny the validity of the principle.
You think it's more of an eschatological reality?
No, I don't think it's an eschatological reality.
It's a correlation causation mistake.
I mean, this is an ongoing discussion that Dr. Truman and I have been having for many years.
I see.
He's trying to reform me of this principle. He hasn't succeeded yet.
Well, John Murray, for instance, was one who was very keen on this principle.
Yes, he
and
was.
If people are interested in some applications of this, you can read his collected writings.
Yes.
I forget which volume, but you're going to find some materials that in which he's talking about ecclesiology and using the establishment principle. Let's speak about the right of patronage a little in the Veto Act as we set the stage for many of these great figures we're going to be speaking about.
Okay.
What are those two things and what were their significance in causing and bringing about this disruption?
Well, as Cardinal's already mentioned, under patronage, the way that ministers were placed in parishes was by appointment by the local landowner. Sometimes by the local council, if they were in towns. As the Church of Scotland enters the 19th century, however, evangelicals within the church are expressing real concern over the spiritual independence of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Because as much as the establishment principle says that there is to be a link between the church and the state, if you look at the original language of the Westminster Confession of Faith on this, they make it very clear that the church is to be spiritually independent. And so in the 19th century, the Church of Scotland evangelicals are arguing that the church had the sole right to decide who matters that had to do with the spiritual matters in the church, and particularly the appointment of ministers. So in 1834, the Church of Scotland actually passes something called the Veto Act.
Mm.
And what the Veto Act was an attempt to restrict the power of patronage by giving to male heads of families the right to veto the parish patron's appointment of minister. So that was an attempt on the part of the Church of Scotland, the evangelicals within the Church of Scotland, to reform the system.
Was it a blackball situation, or is there a majority vote, or how did they weigh these vetoes?
Well, what they said was that in order for a minister to be appointed to a parish and ordained or installed by the presbytery, he had to have a majority vote by male heads of families.
I see.
The name could only be proposed by the patron, presumably.
That is correct. The name was proposed by the patron, but the congregation had the right under this act to say, no, we don't think this is the right man for us.
Sure.
Now, in reality, there were many situations where there was good cooperation between patrons and parishes.
Well, he doesn't want a whole land full of people that don't like him, you know. Presumably.
Exactly. So, I mean, in many circumstances, these things were worked out informally, but it was becoming increasingly difficult to do that. So the Church of Scotland passes the Patronage Act in 1834, and there's an immediate test of it. There's a parish in Perthshire where out of a total of 336 heads of family, only two of them agreed to the appointment of the minister. So when the presbytery got this information, they refused to ordain the man.
Right.
And then he sued. He took the presbytery to court.
Mm-hmm.
And the courts found in his favor, and the courts directed that he be ordained and installed in the parish.
Mm.
Now, ultimately, it took a long time. It took a long time for this to work its way through the courts, and I just checked this morning. He actually was not installed in the parish until after the disruption. He wasn't installed till 1843. It took a long time, but that was the first test. And then between 1834 and 1843, what came to be known as the 10 Years' Conflict, there were a series of these situations which escalated, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And which ultimately took the Church of Scotland in the direction that where the disruption happened in 1843.
That's wonderful.
Now, I think it's important to note here that when the disruption took place in 1843, the Church of Scotland lost a significant number of men.
Mm-hmm.
They lost 470 ministers, 192 candidates for the ministry, and the entire missionary force of the church. So all of the missionaries decided that they would leave the Church of Scotland and go to the Free Church, which had a real impact on the subsequent outlook of the church, which was very evangelistic and missionary-minded.
And also prospects of future growth, potentially.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Now, the percentage of candidates is interesting there, and obviously there's a lot at stake for many of these men to leave their denomination, much the same way we find many parallels in the OPC's history and, mm-hmm. and in other Presbyterian histories. Mm-hmm. What was at stake for these men to actually leave? And why might it have been easier for a younger person to do so?
Well, if you were a parish minister in the Church of Scotland and you joined the Free Church, you lost your home because all of the churches had manses. So you lost your home, you lost the building in which your congregation worshipped, and you lost your stipend. Mm-hmm. So you lost everything. Now, the reality is that for some in the what came to be known as the Free Church, they had been very well prepared for this. They could see it coming. And so they had begun to put systems in place. Many congregations were able, particularly the more wealthy ones, were actually able to construct buildings so that they were able to move from one building to another fairly easily. But that was the minority.
Certainly.
The vast majority of people who left the Church of Scotland in May of 1843 had nowhere to go. Mm. They gave up everything. Then they were prepared to do that.
Mm. I mean, the conviction is just so admirable there. But to see that this is no casual decision. Of course, sometimes we think, somebody got upset and they decided to form a new denomination. This is no laughing matter and nothing taken lightly.
There was a lot of thought that went into it.
Now, is it the case that you've come out of the Canadian branch of the Free Church?
I was an elder in the Toronto congregation of the Free Church of Scotland. And the roots of the Free Church in Canada are interesting. There was significant immigration to Canada from Scotland in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Is that where Nova Scotia comes from?
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I would say the majority of the immigration to Canada from Scotland were Presbyterian.
Mm.
So Presbyterianism was well established in Canada, certainly by the end of the 18th century and into the 19th century. When 1843 happened, those in the various Presbyterian synods in Canada either aligned themselves with the Free Church or the Church of Scotland. And that was the case for the next 30 years or so. By 1875, however, there was a movement to bring all the sort of disparate groups of Canadian Presbyterians together. And the vast majority of Canadian Presbyterians went into a church union in 1875.
Hmm.
There were some Free Church congregations left at that point. They didn't join the union. And the reasons why they didn't join the union were interesting. There were a number of them. The new church in Canada, which Dr. Truman would be happy about, didn't accept the establishment principle.
These subjects of the crown?
Some good things in Canada, obviously. I need to take back some of my criticisms.
They also removed the larger and shorter catechisms as subordinate standards of the church.
Not so good.
And they also, the new church in Canada adopted instrumental music and worship and also hymns.
I see.
So those combinations of issues prevented some from going into the new Presbyterian denomination in Canada. I cannot profess to be an expert on Canadian Presbyterian church history, but that's sort of a thumbnail sketch.
Well, it's helpful to realize that, and perhaps it's a subject of future episodes, some things we can speak about in the future. I mean, I'm curious myself.
Yeah.
I was speaking with Daryl Hart just a couple of days ago, and he was very interested in the Canadian history. So I think it's a subject of interest for many people, even people well familiar with American and potentially British Presbyterianism as well.
So if I can just finish up.
Please.
By the early 20th century, there were still a few Free Church congregations in Canada and in North America. As of now, there are four. There's one in Toronto where I was a ruling elder. Mm-hmm. There are three in Prince Edward Island, and then there's one in a suburb of Detroit, Michigan.
I see.
So those are the Free Church congregations that remain in North America.
Wonderful. Now, as we turn more to the specifics of this book, it's a collection of 10 shorter biographies of 10 figures 10 founders of the Free Church of Scotland. And I thought the construction of the book and the way that you chose to wrote it is very interesting. I'm wondering if there is any particular reason you chose to collect and write a history through the lens of each of one of these figures, if there's a particular perspective that might be gained on the church in general by looking at individuals in particular.
Well, I'm a firm believer that the best history is told through the lives of people.
Mm-hmm.
And these were real people. They were people who had successes and failures. They were people at times who were heroic.
Yeah.
And at other times made massive mistakes.
Some very tragic scenes
and
in this
some
book.
And some of their lives were really touched by tragedy. My intention in writing the book the way that I did was to try and produce something that didn't engage in either hero worship or character assassination. There was a whole series of books done in the 19th century looking back on the so-called disruption worthies. and largely they are hagiographic pieces, which make all of these men look as if they virtually could do no wrong. And I think it's really important to see these men for who they were and what mm-hmm. they were able to contribute. As to why I did it this way rather than to do a more traditional history of the Free Church, I think a more traditional denominational history would track the main events, but it might not highlight the lives of the real people that made up the Free Church. And so mm-hmm. what I was trying to do was move from institutional history to personal history.
Mm-hmm. That's one. It's an interesting perspective on the subject, and I was refreshed in reading it because it's not just a pro forma book.
Yeah.
It's a helpful perspective on the subject. What is your take on that, biographies and history? I mean, do you agree with what Sandy's saying? Have you found it helpful to read this book, and has it shed any additional light on the subject that you haven't seen before, Dr. Truman?
Yes. I mean, I read Sandy's book very much against the background of the tradition of the sort of potted biographies that you'd find in books like The Disruption Worthies, or even Annals of the Disruption would be been another famous piece of hagiography. And the way I saw what I saw Sandy doing was, in some ways, he answered some of the questions that I was left with, having read this 19th century hagiography. There's a famous dispute, for example, between R.S. Candlish, Robert Smith Candlish, mm-hmm. and William Cunningham, which threatens to tear the church apart, and which certainly left Candlish and Cunningham at points unwilling to speak to each other. The way it's dealt with in the 19th century hagiographies is, even in the massive biographies of Candlish and Cunningham, is that you'll get reference suddenly to, oh, and by the time they died, Candlish and Cunningham had put aside their differences.
Mm.
And you're left scratching your head thinking, well, what differences? Nobody mentioned any differences.
The kids are all right.
One of those kind of things. So, well, I think what Sandy did was provide, he showed where the bodies are buried, if I could put it that way, without shattering the image of these men as men who'd sacrificed a lot and were men of great principle.
Right.
Also demonstrated that church leaders are flawed. And I think there's a pastorally important aspect to that in mm-hmm. that we can tend to like our church leaders to be larger than life, and we can tend to root a lot of the power of their ministry in their perfection. Mm-hmm. What a book like this does is indicate great men can achieve great things, but they're not that different to the rest of us. And I think mm-hmm. that is, to me, that's not a disturbing thing. That's actually an encouraging thing.
Yeah, I think so. You read about somebody and you see their real faults, but yet you see them in light of the many things that they were able to achieve by God's grace, then it is a very encouraging thing. Yeah. And I think a better history certainly a more accurate one at that.
One example would be Sandy, talk more about this, but Hugh Miller,
mm-hmm.
who is one of the great elders, he's not a minister, he's an elder, one of the great journalists of the disruption, ultimately works himself to a point where he has a mental collapse and kills himself.
Mm-hmm.
That led to Miller either being written out of the history in the 19th century, or that his tragic end being highly glossed.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't help Christians today, I don't think, in their grappling with mental illness, for example.
Exactly.
And to know that somebody like that suffered so terribly is pastorally helpful today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. even someone of such significance in this history. Speaking of significant figures, the book appropriately, I think, begins with Thomas Chalmers. Mm-hmm. You've named him or labeled him visionary pastor. Can you provide us some background into Chalmers and some of his just massive significance for this figure, or for this period, I should say?
He was born in 1780, lived till 1847, died tragically young in many ways. Was the first moderator of the Free Church. He was called by Thomas Carlyle the chief Scottish man of his time, and by Karl Marx the arch parson.
Karl Marx.
He's the only Presbyterian to be mentioned in Das Kapital, I think.
Chalmers was...
You're quite envious of that.
I'm waiting for the second edition.
Chalmers was a very accomplished pastor, social reformer, theologian, and church leader. Uh-huh. He wasn't converted until actually during his first pastorate,
which
is interesting.
Yeah,
I mean, he subsequently said in later life that his conversion largely came through preparing and preaching his own sermons, which is very interesting.
Didn't he make a notorious statement about why you should go into the ministry before he was converted? he said something to the effect of this was at a general assembly, I believe. He stood up and said something to the effect of being in the ministry is great because you only have to sort of work one day a week and I spend the other 6 days on my mathematical studies.
Something like that, yes. I mean, not only was he successful pastor and theologian, but he held several university posts, St. Andrews, the University of Edinburgh, and then after the disruption, New College in Edinburgh. He was a prolific author. I think his complete works run to something like 30 volumes.
Which is amazing.
Depending on which edition you use. And he wrote on economics. His first book was actually on economics, and it was panned by the critics, which he really, really disliked. He was badly upset by the fact that he got bad reviews for his first book. Wrote books on astronomy, philosophy, as well as theology.
Oh, wow.
So he was, in many respects, a Renaissance man of his time.
He did popular Bible study notes.
Yes,
as well,
he did. His daily Bible readings and Sabbath Bible readings are very, very well done, and make for very good reading and are very pastorally wise.
Mm. Now, I can't help but think about the parallels to Machen, or I should think about that the other way around, how Machen's life, you know, being a younger man, dying short of his time, supposedly, and being the first moderator of the General Assembly, it's interesting to ask the question, how might the Free Church have been different had Chalmers lived a much longer, fuller life? Would this history have turned out differently?
It's hard to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
I think the disruption would still have happened without Chalmers. I think the group that ultimately formed the Free Church would still have broken away from the Church of Scotland without Chalmers, but they would not have been nearly as well organized, and they wouldn't have been nearly as forward looking without him. There's no question about that.
You mentioned his negotiating skills. Was he rather adept at keeping the church together or working through some of these political issues?
He was very good at mobilizing forces within the church. There were some famous meetings in 1841 and 42 where it was touch and go whether or not the coalition that he had brought together around him would hang together. He was very successful in that regard. He was not nearly as successful when he was called upon to negotiate with the government on issues of support for the church. And in fact, he had a formidable temper. There are several instances of it being reported where he didn't get what he wanted and getting very, very angry indeed. And it's possible that that certainly didn't help the cause.
Mm-hmm.
I do think the Free Church would still have happened without Chalmers. It probably would have looked somewhat different, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's no doubt but that Chalmers' early death weakened the Free Church. Because when you have someone who is a charismatic leader, even when you have able men step in to replace you, it's going to look differently. And it did. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm. It's another fascinating study, and a very young church losing one of its principal figures and having to deal with it at that. But certainly the Free Church was very well stocked, I should say, with minds and with figures, another one being Robert Candlish, we've already mentioned. You call him preacher and churchman. What were some of the significant attributes and things that Candlish was able to do in his lifetime?
He was a very able theologian and preacher. Spurgeon said of him that a man hardly needs anything beyond Candlish. He is devout, candid, prudent, and forcible. And in many ways, that is a good description of Candlish. He, as we've said, became the de facto leader of the Free Church after Chalmers' death. He was responsible for ecumenical relations with other churches in the United Kingdom, played a key role in a number of debates that would shape the early years of the Free Church. The one where he fell out with William Cunningham was over the question of church education and whether or not the Free Church should have one or more seminaries to train its pastors. Candlish was of the view that the church should try and set up as many seminaries and places of education as it could so that more people could have accessible ministerial training. Cunningham was of the belief that the church really could only properly resource one. And so he wanted that to be New College in Edinburgh. He was also concerned that the church would not be able to adequately track what was being taught in the classroom if they spread the education around the church. And I think history shows that Cunningham was right. There's no doubt about that in my mind. Even though the church decided in the direction that Candlish wanted and ended up setting up seminaries in other parts of Scotland. It was not, in retrospect, it was not the right decision.
Have you read
to add to that?
Well, just add a sort of contemporary anecdote. There was a Free Church college in Aberdeen, one of the cities where they established a college. And if you walk to the top of Union Street in Aberdeen today, the building is still there. And there are two sort of mock eternal flames outside. It's now a kind of club stroke bar called The College. And there's a plaque in the doorway commemorating that William Robertson Smith, the Old Testament scholar, taught there for the Free Church. And William Robertson Smith in some ways epitomized the Free Church at its most intellectually brilliant and theologically most flawed in the 19th century. And the fact that the Free Church College is now basically a club speaks eloquently, I think, to the correctness of Cunningham's judgment on the Cunningham-Candlish College question.
Yeah.
Now, I notice also that he received a Doctor of Divinity from Princeton in 1841. Did either of you have any did that come into view at all, the fact that he had some American education?
He didn't have an American education.
He just received the D.D.?
It was an honorary D.D.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he felt deeply honored by that. But no, it was an honorary D.D.
I see. Yeah. Well, what were some factors? I don't want to go too far off our path, but what were some factors leading up to them inviting him? What were some of the reasons or circumstances for inviting a Free Churchman to come to Princeton?
Well, I think part of what was going on is that there were a group within the Presbyterian Church in the States that were very supportive of what had been going on in Scotland in terms of the dispute within the Church of Scotland leading up to the disruption. And I think it was in some ways an expression of their support for the evangelical cause in the Free Church that motivated the awarding of the honorary D.D. That's my read of it.
Yeah. Well, that would certainly make sense.
Yeah.
Well, Candlish, certainly a deserving figure. I guess as we assess, would you say that he was suitable to carry this load that was left when Chalmers had passed?
Well, he was as I've already said, he was a very different figure than Chalmers. He certainly wasn't as polished as Chalmers. There's a quote in my book from someone who describes his physical appearance, and he always looked a terrible mess. Contemporary pictures of him show that he could have used a hairdresser. but no, he was very he was a different figure. There's no question about that. He lacked polish, but what he lacked for in polish, he certainly had plenty of energy and passion. He had a very clear understanding of the gospel. Was a very gifted preacher. Very well regarded in that in his time on that. He was also a very capable writer. Mm-hmm. And even today, his commentaries on Genesis and the first epistle of John are still very much in print and still well worth reading. Probably his single largest theological contribution was a book that was based on a series of lectures he gave on the fatherhood of God. And they're certainly well worth people spending some time with.
I think a mutual friend of ours, you know, James Dolzell, has some rare editions of Candlish, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So. It's very difficult to get Candlish on the secondhand market, actually. Mm-hmm. Sort of original first edition stuff. Very, mm-hmm. very difficult to get hold of.
Yeah. Well, you know where they are now, James said. William Cunningham, the name we've already mentioned, is a massive figure in terms of Presbyterian ecclesiology. Works at, what is it, the Church of Christ, I think is? Or
no, that was James Bannerman.
That's Bannerman, but that's what I'm thinking, the other figure being Bannerman. But Cunningham also has some excellent work on the subject, and we could throw in, if I might, Stuart Robinson on that subject as well. Some wonderful thinkers in this era, not only in Scotland, but also in the United States. What might we say for Cunningham in terms of his abilities? You know, many of these other guys were excellent preachers. But Cunningham, you mentioned, was not so much, or at least wasn't received well.
Yeah.
How was he able to still remain a very significant and influential figure without that charisma that endeared him to other people?
Well, if you look at his published sermons, they read very well, very solid content and very well crafted. Contemporary accounts indicate, however, that he essentially read his sermons, which was not perhaps the best way to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh Miller at one point says with exasperation in one letter, oh, that Cunningham would preach his sermons. So he wasn't a great pulpiteer.
Mm-hmm.
His greatest contribution to the Free Church was as a theologian, and he served the church as professor of church history from 1844 to 1847, and then in addition as principal of New College from Chalmers' death to Cunningham's own death in 1861.
See.
So it was primarily as an educator that Cunningham made his contribution. Most of his works that we have today were published in book form after his death.
Mm.
When he died, he handed on, all of his papers were handed on and were prepared for publication subsequent to his death.
Mm.
Some of his material was published during his lifetime. He did edit a theological journal where some of his material came out, but the bulk of it came out posthumously.
Now, did Cunningham spend some time in the United States?
Yes. He was here in 1844.
Okay.
He came over here just shortly after the disruption, and he came here largely on a tour to let people know what had happened in Scotland.
I see.
And to visit churches in the States, and essentially to drum up financial support for the Free Church. Mm-hmm. There was a delegation sent over here. Cunningham was one of four. Two went south to the southern states, including Cunningham, and then two went to the northern states and into Canada. Sadly for Cunningham, his time here in the States is largely remembered because of controversy.
Mm.
The Free Church had been quite clear in denouncing slavery, and then Cunningham went to Presbyterian churches where there were slave owners and raised funds in those churches. And the trip, from a financial point of view, was quite successful. He raised something like $9,000 from southern churches, which was a lot of money in 1844.
Were they Confederate?
But then,
not yet.
But then
you've got all this money. We'd love to give you.
Yeah,
we could print you some more. How much do you want?
Yes. But then he goes back to Scotland, and all these people start looking and saying, well, aren't you the guy who's been denouncing slavery? What have you? Why have you gone and taken money from these churches? It's not – Cunningham did not handle it well, and I don't think the Free Church handled it well, be honest with you. It's not a period of history that – it's not a period of history that they should be terribly proud of. I mean, Carl mentioned that in a lot of these 19th century biography, these things sort of get papered over. Mm-hmm. And in Cunningham's biography, there's a lengthy chapter on this. And at the very end of the chapter, it all says, well, it all got settled. And that's basically all it says, without giving very much detail.
Mm. Dr. Truman, could you perhaps let us know a little bit about the figure Hugh Miller, being a journalist? I realize that you have some familiarity with him.
Hugh Miller is one of the strange characters of 19th century Scotland in many ways. He grew up on the West Coast. He had a fairly poor upbringing. He trained as a stonemason. Throughout his life, he had a strong depressive tendency. Loved being photographed by gravestones. I have a photograph of him in my office posing by a gravestone. But also had this remarkable gift for writing. He wrote a number of books that are still in, you get them still in print in my schools, and Schoolmasters would be one of them. He was appointed by Candlish to edit a newspaper called The Witness because basically the Scottish press was opposed to, well, it was pro-patronage. This was before the disruption. It was basically pro-the establishment. And Candlish realized that there was a war of ideas to be won at a more popular level. It was one thing to be winning the intellectual war, but there's also a populist dimension to this. And had the inspired brilliance to appoint Hugh Miller as the editor of this newspaper, The Witness.
That's interesting.
Which became the popular organ for getting pro-Chalmers Party material out there. It would be the modern-day equivalent of having a website or something like that. And Miller had this remarkable gift with language and would often produce the entire newspaper himself. He would be churning out 10,000 publishable words a week, week after week. Ultimately, after the disruption, he was sort of forgotten about by the great and the good. He became something of an embarrassment. They marginalized him. He was never really given by men like Candlish and company the credit for what he'd done in terms of broader public opinion. The disruption could never have been as successful as it was without him being instrumental in building public opinion. It'd be like today's equivalent of a popular radio show host or something. He was marginalized, and ultimately he took his own life when became very seriously mentally ill towards the end. His wife, Lydia, was a very accomplished lady novelist, and she even wrote a novel based on the disruption. They're long out of print. I guess they probably suffer from many 19th century novels for being a bit wooden these days, but a remarkable literary family. He also embodied an aspect of the Free Church that I think is difficult for outsiders to grasp, and that is that the Free Church, certainly in its West Coast and island manifestation in Scotland, is an interesting fusion of what we would call confessional Presbyterianism and mysticism. You read Hugh Miller, and one minute he's talking about the doctrines of grace. Mm-hmm. The next minute he's sort of describing the fairies that live at the bottom of his garden. I mean, there is this strange Highland mysticism. I only have some insight into it because my wife is a West Scotland mystic. So I'm a kind of son of the Enlightenment. She's a West Highland mystic, and I see in her of that aspect of 19th century Free Church life.
He wasn't at all some sort of the impetus or the influence for the Highlander series of movies, was he? This,
I don't think so.
Hooking around with this heightened sense that you might be surrounded by other immortals.
Or something.
I see. But interestingly enough, you mentioned him being photographed by gravestones. I wonder if that has anything to do with his interest in geology. and the stones.
Of course, I'd forgotten that. He was also a 19th century geologist, very interested in fossils, in sandstone.
Didn't he not discover some fossils of fish that became very important?
Yes, he did. They were actually named. They were named after him.
Hmm. Yeah. What, Sandy, what were some of his contributions, not only just what he discovered and found in terms of science, but in terms of being a theologian and an opinion shaper who was influential with science?
Well, I don't think it would be entirely correct to call him a theologian.
Okay. But organ of the church in some.
Well, I mean, some fashion. Carl has already indicated his pivotal role in rallying public support behind the disruption.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say is he was very concerned to make sure that people saw that there wasn't any dispute between or any tension between the geological record and scripture. Now, this is pre-Darwinian, obviously.
Right.
But he was concerned to say that we needn't feel troubled by the geological record as Christians, that we shouldn't feel intimidated by that. I think the other contribution of Miller is that he made sure that the church had an interest in things that were sort of outside the strict boundaries of the church. In other words, he was very concerned about education. He was very concerned about social issues. I mean, we haven't talked about that very much so
right.
far.
So many of these other figures were as well.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's two other people I wrote about in the book, James Begg and Thomas Guthrie. I mean, Begg, who was the most conservative of theological forces in the church, but yet was very concerned about housing for the poor.
Didn't he want government subsidies for music halls to keep the men out of the pubs?
That's exactly right. And then Thomas Guthrie famously set up the whole ragged school movement, which was education for essentially street children, which had a massive impact on the day.
Actually, the beginnings of Sunday school in the United States were for that very reason as well.
That's right. Mm. And so Miller was very instrumental in rallying support for those various causes as well. The other thing about Miller that's interesting and I think contributes to his later marginalization in the church is that he had a falling out with Candlish.
Mm.
Candlish tried to take over his newspaper, essentially. because Candlish wanted it to be an official organ of the Free Church. And Miller was very concerned that it maintain a independent voice.
I see.
And Miller went very, very public with his opposition to Candlish, and Candlish kind of backtracked at a million miles an hour. But that certainly didn't help in terms of Miller's place in the official histories of the church.
That, I think, touches on something else that you've got to remember. For guys like Miller, and he was not unique in this, many of them did not see the disruption as a permanent thing.
Oh.
They saw it as something that would bring the church to its senses, and they hoped to be able to rejoin, that the church would reunite once it had set its house in order.
Was Andrew Bonar one of the figures sympathetic with that view? Or
that I don't know.
No,
no.
Bonar. Well, at one point, Bonar was interested in the church reunion, as it came to be known later in the 19th century. But he eventually backed away from that when it was clear that the church union movement later in the century was going to do so on the basis of a watered down version of the Westminster Confession. At that point, Bonar backed away.
Mm. But Miller was very wary of any kind of triumphalism involved in what was going on in the Free Church. I don't know if that impacted his relationship with Candlish, of course, but Candlish's big ambitions to the Free Church would probably not have sat well with a man like Hugh Miller.
Mm-hmm. Just in our remaining time, do either of you have any other big things that I don't want to skip over before speaking about the church in the 21st century, but other figures, Thomas Guthrie, James Begg, we mentioned Bonar, but John Duncan, Alexander Duff, and John Kennedy.
Yeah.
Are there any major lessons you would like our listeners to learn from these in just our remaining time here before they actually read the book?
Well, Alexander Duff is interesting because he was essentially involved in pioneer missionary efforts in India. was very responsible for the setting up of schools in India, which had a massive impact on Indian culture and society going forward. John Kennedy is an interesting figure. He was the pastor of the Free Church in Dingwall for more than 40 years throughout his entire ministry, stayed in the same church. His preaching had a massive impact on the church. He was very strong, strongly confessionally based, was very wary of any innovations that might be brought into the church, both in terms of theology and practice.
Big friend of Spurgeon's.
Big friend of Spurgeon's. When they built a new, when the new Free Church was opened in Dingwall, Spurgeon was invited to speak at the opening. And that was the only time that anything other than a metrical psalm was sung in the Dingwall Free Church. John Duncan, there's a whole chapter in the book, but we could say a lot. I could say a lot about him. He was a very successful pastor. He was missionary to the Jews in Europe. Very, very brilliant man, but totally eccentric. After the disruption, he was called back from the mission field and was given the chair of Old Testament at New College. It was a disaster. There was nothing wrong with his theology, but he was a hopeless teacher. And I think some of the responsibility for the future sort of theological drift of the Free Church has to be laid at his door because he didn't successfully communicate with his students. He was well-loved. But he was totally eccentric. So, I mean, it makes the important point that the church and the academy need to be careful about who they put in positions of teaching. Because that has a major impact on the future direction of the church.
Absolutely. It is a lesson well learned.
You mentioned Bannerman earlier.
Yeah.
I would just like to say, Bannerman's two volumes, The Church of Christ, best book ever written on the church. With the exception of the section on the establishment principle, I have no hesitation in recommending that
book. Bannerman gets absolutely right.
I would say to any listeners who haven't got it, haven't read it,
I believe it's from Banner of Truth. Do they still publish an edition of it?
It's in print with Banner of Truth. You can get it on Google Books, I think.
So I would say
do get hold of this book and read it. It is excellent.
Yeah, it is. It's a fantastic two-volume set, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct.
Speaking of the church into the 21st century and the lessons that we learned from these men and this disruption moving forward, how might we understand the church's mission through the lives and through the concerns of these people? What should the church be concerned about, and how should the church move forward amidst struggles such as these?
Well, I think if you look at the Free Church in totality, they had a very clear mission of what the church should be. First and foremost, this was a very outward-looking church that believed passionately in the Great Commission. They were strenuous supporters of the missionary movement and were passionate about evangelism and education. You didn't find too many people in the Free Church sitting around looking at each other and worrying about the state of the church today. They were out being busy.
They took Matthew 16:18 at its word.
Yes, they did. They also had a very strong belief that the church should have an impact on the world around them. They had a real social conscience. I mean, we've mentioned briefly James Begg and Thomas Guthrie. They're two guys that are perhaps the most obvious examples of the Free Church's social conscience, but there were many, many others. So they really, the Free Church passionately believed that it was their commission to show the love of Christ to the poor and disadvantaged in tangible ways. So in many ways, it's a very attractive ecclesiology and view of the church that was presented here.
I was very much struck by this book, and again, I want to thank you for writing it and for sharing with us in a very accessible way the lessons of many of these founders of the Free Church of Scotland and how we as 21st century Presbyterians in the United States can still learn many lessons from them. Thank you so much for this book, Sandy, and for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also, Dr. Truman, thanks for stopping by. You can read Dr. Truman's, how should we put this, multifaceted personalities on reformation21.org. He writes under several different pseudonyms. I hope I'm not letting the cat out of the bag.
News to me.
I think you're thinking of somebody else.
Oh, is it? Rodney Trotter. Thanks for stopping by, Dr. Truman, and again for his recent book, reprint of the book, The Reformation, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, which we interviewed him about two episodes ago. So thank you so much for stopping by. We also want to mention, of course, that you can find us online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information not only about all of our programs and this book, Unity and Diversity, but about a host of other books that we've been speaking about lately and the authors we've been interviewing. And many of our resources are available there, and they're all free of charge. So visit us online at reformedforum.org and download and learn to your heart's content. But I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.